Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie, and I'm delighted to be interviewing the great Helen Lederer, a great comic star of absolutely fabulous One Foot in the Grave, French and Saunders, Young Ones, New Statesman, the list goes on. Dawn French called her the third funniest woman in Britain. She's currently in Fawlty Towers on stage. And what's more, she also runs the Comedy Women in Print Prize, which has just announced its long list. Now, I was going to start, Helen, talking about your wonderful memoir, Not That I'm Bitter. And in the early 80s, you joined the Comedy Store in 1982, is that right? We're just hearing about Greg Wallace's escapades.
straight in with a controversial element.
Your wonderful memoir is great because you think, how wonderful to be a famous comedian in the early 80s, but it's quite tough and the men are not really very nice to you.
Well, I wasn't famous in 1982. I love the thought of comedy. I'm now deconstructing your beautiful introduction, but the membership of the Comedy Store wasn't exactly like the Groucho Club, but I did get gigs there. I do remember one of the early gigs when I was in a double act with the late, I'm so old now that, you know, everyone is dead except I'm not, just about alive. And my late double act partner, Maggie Fox, and I did our routine, and then somebody in the audience asked to see a piece of my anatomy. And yes. As if it was quite...
Begins with CL, yes, ends in IT.
You've heard this one. But as if it was normal. So I think, you know, going back to your kind of...
Well, your response to that was very good. What was
contextual
that?
Question. I said I hadn't brought it with me that night. But I mean, that was true. And the thing is, what is one's response to that? I do remember going home and buying some chocolate in the garage in the petrol station, and maybe that was significant or not. But the fact that that was normal, although a bit stand out, tells you how the times were. And obviously you can't be broken by audiences, and society has evolved and continues to evolve. So I'm kind of quite circumspect about censorship, reaction, conversation. Words are different now, aren't they? So we know that, and you know that, Harry, don't you? I mean, you can't say certain words, and you're careful not to offend.
That's the John Turode row, yeah, at the moment.
Yes. Yeah. So, and people want sound bites. They want quick sound bites. Why? So they get more copy. I think people should be a bit more thoughtful and have nice, good, encouraging conversations and learn a bit and change a bit. I think we're all a bit still running scared, don't you think? And it's just a lot of hoo-ha when we should be getting on with our jobs and doing the real stuff. This doesn't feel very genuine. It's surface.
And also, presumably, however unpleasant it was, people barracking you like that, makes you incredibly tough, at least on the surface, doesn't it?
On the surface, I mean, I look back, I'm not a particularly confident person. On the other hand, to carry on, you know, having some autonomy over your life, writing your own material, getting to your own gigs, hassling people. I'm a hustler. I'm very much a hustler. And then in those days, I was, the lovely Maggie said I was very ambitious, as if that wasn't entirely complimentary. Yeah. But on the other hand, when you have a passion for something, then we are all ambitious. And I think there's a time when you get going and started trying to break into something that you really want to do. God knows why, looking back. I mean, it's quite thankless going to pubs and playing to three people, two of whom are cross, you're not a man, you know. But I wanted to do it, and it was the only thing I could do. I wasn't a very good social worker, so it was probably best on balance.
And not a very good masseuse, as you describe it.
You've read the memoir. Yes. But all these things that I put in the memoir because it was that very open, I'm not going to do a memoir again, and looking, I sent it off to the publisher and I said, obviously you can take things out. And they said, we're not taking anything out. And that should have alarmed me. Maybe I should have censored it. But I'm not, I don't censor myself. I think I'm just very honest. And if you don't put all the difficult bits in, then it's not a proper book, in my view.
I like what Oscar Wilde said about a discreet diary. There's no point in it, and it's extremely honest.
Yeah.
And looking back at it...
Messy. It's messy.
Yeah, well, very, very, very funny, very, very rude in parts. And looking back at it, particularly if, like me, you grew up watching you on all those wonderful shows with amazing people like I listed, but also Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie... Emma Thompson, the late Tony Slattery, Harry Enfield. It looked like you were part of a gang,
yes. But
actually in your very funny memoir you describe your second wedding, we have to scrabble together we some lebs for OK magazine.
They were a little bit, there was kind of polite question when we had to give the guest list, like, were there any others? I mean, it wasn't normal to get married and do it in OK, but it was a different time. And I had an amazing agent at the time, Luigi Bonhomme, amazing agent. He said, tell you what, why don't... And he did the deal. And then there were polite questions as to who certain people were in the photographs. Felicity Montague, who plays the brilliant PA to Steve Coogan in the comedy series. And I hope she won't mind me saying, but I had to say, don't you know who Felicity Montague is? But obviously it wasn't known in OK circles at the time.
But so you weren't part of that gang. You appear with them the whole time, but they weren't all friends.
Harry, I'm not part of any gang. I think, yes, I was a double act to get me going, although I was doing comedy on my own before, and it was a beautiful thing to connect with someone else because it's... You know, you get confidence from being a double act. Equally, my way has always probably been on my own. That's the only way I know it. I mean, being in a theatre group, troupe now, it is a community. And because you don't have a life, you're doing 8 shows a week. They have to be your family. And there's something very lovely about belonging with other people, albeit in a temporary way. But I always have to go and lie down in a dark room on my own, whatever job I'm doing. I sort of throw myself into it and then have to get solitary. I think that's normal though, isn't it?
Yes.
You can't be ha-ha-he all the time.
And do you think applies, used to annoy the late, great Barry Pryor, the idea that comics were miserable. I think a lot of people are miserable. Electricians and plumbers are miserable.
Yeah, everyone is miserable. And also, I would say that happiness isn't a particular goal of mine. It's not an expectation. I think what's nice is absence of anxiety. So that would be my closest to happiness. You go, oh, I'm not anxious. But one is what one is, and you just get used to it. You just live with it. I don't know if I'm normal or not normal. I wouldn't like other people to know what's going inside my head all the time because, as I said earlier, it could be a bit messy and critical. But then, you see, if you're kind of person like yourself or me, we like detail. So we notice all sorts of things and that amuses me. But it might be perceived as critical and judgmental to someone else.
Two go together. If you're very sensitive and you notice things, you notice the way people behave, that makes you an extremely good impersonator of people, but it also means you're oversensitive to other things.
Yes.
But to go back to that gang, it's fair enough to say in your memoir you had relationships with both Harry Enfield and Rick Mail.
Well, I don't know what having relationships, we could deconstruct what that means. I think getting off with, did you remember that term?
It's a great word.
As a kind of 90s, getting off with. And I think in those days, not that I have to justify with a morality spin on it, but, you know, people weren't married.
Two brilliant men.
Nobody was... I was lucky to meet and know amazing individuals who appeared to like me and who appeared to like what I was doing. And I'm sort of now, as I've been promoting the book, it is an odd thing to declare that one is not a virgin at one's age. But actually, most people are not virgins, Harry. It's quite normal behaviour to get off with people.
Well, everyone does, but also, isn't it, when they're these great... I think they're geniuses, but your book, you're very honest about them. With Rick Mail, the two brilliant quotes he says to you. At one stage, he says about you, be careful with her. What do you think he meant? That was a nice thing.
I know. I thought about that afterwards. Is it going, or is it, ooh, she's a bit too sensitive, she might be fragile. It's either protective. I'm going to take it as a protective thing because I know that he, the first Edinburgh, it was 83 when I was up with my, that was the first time I was doing stand-up, and they were doing their show. And there were queues around the block to see Ben Elton, Andy De La Tour and Rick Mayall, and not queues to the Masonic Lodge to see myself, Norman Lovett and Arnold Brown. But there weren't women doing their own stand-up at that time, and they genuinely loved what I was doing, and we connected then. But it just felt good. And I'm thinking that you could, you're a literary person. That Isadora Duncan.
Yeah.
See, I'd like to think, don't know too much about her, but she's like a libertine. So I find that's a helpful illustration when people ask questions about, oh, so you've had sex with people. And you go, well, not all the time. And getting off is getting off. And, you know, think about flower power, free love, there's just epochs in society where people connect in a very beautiful way. I'm trying to bring that back into play instead of the judgment diarist.
Judging it at all. I just think they're too terrific. People are just interested to know what they're like.
Yeah, in bed.
Yeah. No, no.
I can tell you.
Oh, no, yes, definitely.
Very nice, very pleasant.
Good, good. and another interesting thing Rick Mayall says to you, it's when you're acting, I think it's in Bottom, and he says, don't crash the laughs,
yes.
Which is quite kind of aggressive, isn't it?
Yes. I think that also is a very respectful, you know, somebody's in their workplace. You know, somebody's in their workplace, it's their product, and the adrenaline's on and you want everything to go right. And that is a kind of sign of a pro, I think. You just want to make sure that the product works. But obviously, I do say in the book that I did feel a bit like a sort of comedy secretary because on the one side, I was doing my own stand-up and writing my material. On the other, I was getting the jobs, good jobs, considered at the time. So you want to serve them, like in a way that June Whitfield maybe had to serve so brilliantly the scripts that came her way. You just want to do a good job of what the people who employ you require and then also do your own thing. I don't think I could just serve the world. I need to do my own thing at the same time.
Yeah. And did you feel like the Rick Mayalls of this world were slightly keeping it one remove? You talk about seeing the great producer, director John Lloyd, and he was at Cambridge and you weren't, and you thought that might not have an effect, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite quick to have a chip on my shoulder. I know that I've gone my own way. So what's good about that is when I talk to other people, you can say, look, there are no rules. If you want to do something and you think about it and there's luck involved as well, you can do it. So I think it's quite inspiring not to be part of the establishment, but that's not to say that the establishment are any lesser. You know, it's not their fault that they went to Cambridge.
Yeah.
I don't hold it against them, Harry.
No. And you come to the end of your book very kind of movingly interesting. You said you became a performer, or you keep on performing, because you thought you were never quite good enough. Is that fair enough?
Yes. It's an odd thing. I was brought up in a middle-class household, and boasting was not encouraged. And I don't like it when other people boast, but maybe, again, that's a sign of the times. Maybe now people talk about their... Or Americans, for instance, is very different in America. Like, modesty is misunderstood there. And I remember going to a meeting there, the one time when they tried to put me into a franchise to do The Weakest Link. Bizarre that I just went for it. And I am not like the woman who
Anne
does...
Robinson.
I am not Anne Robinson. And they were really nice when I arrived and then just showed me the door when I left, which I've heard happens in America, because that's not my vibe. I think now I'm getting praise for the book, and I'm getting praise for being Mrs. Richards in Fawlty Towers. And it is on you. I have to kind of go, okay, that's all right then. But it isn't normal for me to bask or pick up praise.
Although you must have got plenty of it over the years.
I've always compared myself to the queens of comedy, French and Saunders, because of sort of rummaging around the world in roughly the same epoch, although I think they're 2.5, to be precise, years ahead of me. And as brilliant as they are, I think I probably... the jobs were there for them, and a lot of other women, like Dhu McKinnon, and who's younger than me, but there wasn't a rush to kind of replicate more women-led content at the time. And that's okay. I don't moan about it. I'm not really angry about it. Why? That sounds so facetious. It is what it is. You get to where you are when you're at, trying to sound philosophical about it. The main thing is it's happening for me now, aged, I'm quite old. So to do the play and to do the book has really made me finally slightly confident. But it's taken this long.
And interesting, you talk about Dawn French. You say actually she was particularly nice when you were starting off.
Yes.
That fits with, I find that with writers in journalism, the really good ones are the nice ones.
Oh, yes.
They're confident and they're not envious.
Yes, and you pick up... I pick up vibes and auras from people quite quickly. I had such a laugh with her, with Dawn, on something called Happy Families that Ben Elton wrote. And that at that point, you listed the Stephen Fry's and the Hugh Laurie... all of them went on to get a series except me. But that isn't poor me. That is quite funny. So you have to read the book because I really don't mind. I mean, it's funny looking back. I think there is humour in not being part of the main story, but being present. And then when I did an interview for The Guardian at the beginning, a very clever interviewer interviewed me. And she said it's often more interesting reading the books of those people who aren't that famous. But I was there. If I fulfil that brief, I'm very happy to have done that.
I think to be, in so many things, to be an insider outsider.
Yeah. And you can't change that as well. I did sulk in my 40s for a bit, and it is a waste of time sulking. And who likes bitter, hence the title. But are we just on this earth to get praise? No, we're not. We're on this earth to try and be original, do the work, and possibly earn a living, hopefully, from it. And in my case, make people laugh. That's kind of passion of mine.
And your book is also extremely interesting about your life. You are of Czech-Jewish background. And then, if it's all right to talk about it, you had this horrible thing, age 21, of seeing your father die age 52.
Yes.
And you say that has a fundamental effect on you. What effect has it had?
Well, just to be, for anyone who's present at somebody's death, particularly a sudden death, I was still a student and I was home for the Christmas holidays and I was there. Obviously, there's a trauma in that in itself. But in those days, obviously, I went back to college and there wasn't a thought of a counsellor. There wasn't... now one would probably have a procedure or bereavement and hoo-ha. So I do, but it does make me really understand grief because of feeling it, physically feeling it. And it probably made me deeply attracted to powerful men in briefcases thereafter, because I was trying to replicate a kind of whole power trip, because, of course, I put my father on a pedestal. And when he died, age 21, I hadn't quite worked out that, you know, he was probably not at all perfect, you know. But at that point,
he was a senior political advisor.
With Richard Crossman at one point. But he was funny and everyone liked him, so he had a thing. It's funny, you know, so I probably had a kind of father thing going. So I always liked powerful men and then spent a lot of time being frightened of them. So, it gives, it takes away. It's all in the book.
Not all the listeners have read it, but they must read it. To what extent having a Jewish and a Czech background made you one of those outsider insiders? So you're middle class, but as I think, outsider insider, perfect place to be a writer and a comedian. You think that's fair enough?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, we weren't religious. My mother's from the Isle of Wight, so, you know, and I recently did a programme called The Pilgrimage. And the reason that I was asked to do that, which is on iPlayer, was obviously the word mixed heritage. We came up with the word mixed heritage because I'm not Jewish. I don't go to synagogue. You know, I'm not. But I have the background. And it's worth talking about somebody like me, where you have the inherited, you know, cultural, they had to come to this country because they were in concentration camps, and that's all true, but it isn't my story, it's not my life, it's not my religion, but nevertheless it's part of your background, so it does kind of inform, and I was careful on the pilgrimage to try and communicate that in an incredibly honest, respectful way to help, because particularly now, of the world we're in, it's such a sensitive time, rightly so.
And it's a great cliche about to be Jewish is to be funny. I could say this because I'm a quarter Jewish, so my friend says my left leg is very funny. But did that apply to your father? Was he very funny?
He was funny. Yeah. But my mother also was a good storyteller. She liked her Du Bonnet, and she was at Bletchley Park. They didn't talk about it, of course, that's another thing. There is a brick with her maiden name on it. They hastily assembled the brick, actually, for a documentary programme I was doing on Bletchley Park, which was really nice. The brick is still there. Oh. But, you know, that generation of people meeting in the 40s and marrying in the 50s, and the possibilities of women who'd been educated not being able to work in the same way. My parents were kind of quite... they were good, jolly, hard-working people. They weren't posh and they weren't not posh. They were just practical people. And I think that's quite a good base to come from. I think my father would have been pleased at what I'd done, but I am still phobic. Should you want to come to Fawlty Towers, Harry, I can't know when you're in. I'm still phobic. Recently saw a hypnotist for this. About knowing when people are in. So there is... Families are complicated, aren't they? You want to please them, you love them a lot, but they also mess you up. And that's normal.
And on the old subject of class, you describe early on in the comedy store days, being middle class wasn't a good thing. Is that right?
No, it's not the normal class for a comedian, isn't it? Because a comedian's supposed to be the conduit to connect with the proletariat, isn't it? I mean, traditionally, old working people's clubs, you know. But then you see much later than me, we had Miranda Hart, who has the most beautiful enunciated voice. I mean, that's a beautiful voice. But you can only be yourself and authentic. And so if you're authentic, that is your best chance of getting a laugh, because that's your best laugh, best chance of getting recognition. So people don't laugh either on the page or in a stand-up gig if they don't connect with the person.
They spot someone.
They spot the try-hard. Yeah. So it's quite an odd thing to be able to channel who you are and repeat it authentically. But that's what a good stand-up does.
But then later on, you're absolutely brilliant at playing dim, posh people. in Bottom, what's your name?
Oh, contest? Lady somebody, Thingy Smythe, with lots of other names before that, in front.
And Katrina in Ab Fab, who is the perfect dim Sloane. Who were you using as your inspiration?
I found that quite easy to channel, because I live in my head, as you do probably a bit, Harry. So... well, I did ask Jennifer, in those days there were people called Sloane Rangers. So I don't know what's happened to Sloane Rangers. They may have been put on an island.
Well, York, the inventor of them, says that they're there, but they're not rich enough to live in Sloane Square. So you'll find them suddenly in
hiding.
Some strange places.
Prefabs.
In the Northern Line or hidden in Shropshire, but they're still there.
Oh, yes, doing something nice with plants, maybe. I don't know, being satisfied with life. They're benign, happy people. They don't get vexed because, and I think the Catriona lived in her own head, but for some reason that character did chime, and Jennifer did say, oh, cardigans, and just something. I went, chairs, that's it. So you kind of go, a helpful person who's quite pointless. And maybe that's partly, that's me.
and talk quite slowly and always good to not be able to say your R's properly.
Oh, no, that was the other one. That was my colleague, Fleur. She didn't do the R's. I think I was just on another planet, but it's a planet that some people connect to.
But you've always been able to, from a young age, be able to spot types, all sorts of different types, and mimic them and exaggerate them.
I could mimic. It was a way to deal with being in a very strict school, Blackheath High School for Girls. And I did get into trouble, not intentionally. So I was an unintended rebel. And the headmistress, Miss Abraham, had to call me into her office. She had a dog that used to sniff around her ankles. I remember that. And being terrified, so I understand terror and stage fright from they're all connected with authority figures. I have a whole chapter in my book about agents. I do find people in authority really annoying, and I want to, you know, conquer them, but equally one is subservient to them. So I have a problem with authority figures and being told what to do. But I can put up, I can fake it and be very obsequious as well to get on.
Do you think, we were talking before about, you thought you might have ADHD. Don't you think it's more that, no disrespect to your school, but it wasn't catering to a creative, funny person. I think you had a group, were they called the Tampon Gang?
No, I did come up with a creative, it didn't go anywhere, this game, but it did make us laugh a lot. I think it's just going to forbidden areas that you think, the sandwich towel game. I mean, even that word now, people recoil. And when you see adverts, even now on television for all these things, even I want to hide under the duvet. It's
really immediately funny, the sandwich towel.
It's so overt nowadays. All the things for virility. You go, please, this is 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock. Do we need to see this? So, slightly taboo subject. But I did cheat once, so fair enough. And I did do a stink bomb campaign. I didn't do it for notoriety. I did it for genuine reasons. One, to get better marks on my French test. And two, to make people laugh at the stink bomb. But those acts marked me out as a difficult person. So I was known, and I think she must have put that on my Ucker form as well. So if you don't fit, people have to deal with you, don't they? And I didn't fit.
And then it's a cliche, isn't it? But that's a perfect fit for being funny. You're funny in the first place, but also the incredible bravery of doing stand-up. I mean, it's absolutely terrifying.
Well,
it's binary comedy. People either laugh or they don't.
It is, and you do bad gigs or you do good gigs, but for some reason I really wanted to do it. I didn't question it. I didn't think this is a difficult life. I just thought this is what I had to do. And what's interesting, being an actress person, because that's also what I wanted to do, is now I wear a wig and I'm Mrs. Richards. I don't know. Did you watch Fawlty Towers?
Yes, yeah.
So that kind of thing is a different attitude to the audience, because you're not like at your lovely events at the Oldie and the gigs at the literary festivals. I'm looking into the audience and doing the Q&A, and it's a beautiful thing, because whatever happens is unique to that session and connecting. Now, I mustn't do that because I mustn't connect with the audience. So it's a very different experience I'm having.
Sorry, why mustn't you connect with the audience?
I can sense the audience, but you can't break the wall because you've got your wig on and you're doing John Cleese's play.
Yeah.
So I don't think John Cleese would appreciate me doing some impro in the middle of the character. Although in the dress rehearsal, my hat fell off and I did impro because I thought, well, it's a dress rehearsal. Am I allowed to do that? That was noted. But I had to do something because my hat fallen off. So I put in an extra line. But I hope I'm not that annoying person with too many ideas. You know, when you're in a team, you knuckle down and you become part of the team and hope you make the audience laugh and bring to it what you can. But it's very, very different from stand-up.
And it's interesting, you talk about the move from review to stand-up starting just about then. It's quite unusual. Why did that happen? And so it came along perfect
time
for you.
Well, traditionally there have been women in music halls and stuff. And then I'd say in the book, I do a little pricey, and people who don't want to read the history of it can just flick through that bit. But, you know, impressionists got to do their own, women impressionists got their own series, and people who could sing. But it was unusual for women who wrote their own material to front their own programmes. In fact, Emma Thompson did one Miranda did one. We've only had, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, we haven't really had many. So it isn't, it still isn't normal and for women to front their own content.
Because they're being kept out of it, or because it's alpha males pushing themselves forward?
I don't think it's desired by the programme makers who predict the viewing figures. And that's just how it is. And you can't really change the vibes of society. They are changing, but that's how it is at the moment. People are still slightly cross when women have audacity, and I understand that. It's annoying when women are mouthy.
Oh, very funny, yeah.
Well, the, you know, and then what is funny, because you're, we probably laugh at similar things because we like words, but, you know, it's tribal, isn't it? And then you know, certainly you think, oh, yeah, that person isn't going to find me funny. That's okay. I'll go quiet and pretend I'm a different kind of person.
Yeah. To go back to Fawlty Towers, it's funny that some comedy dates quite quickly. Fawlty Towers... never does, does it? I mean, it's still odd. Very, very funny on telly. I haven't yet seen your show, but I will come
must,
and see it.
Yeah, you
but
must.
But I watch it often on telly, and it doesn't date.
I don't know why. Why is it? Is it because it's channeling something British, like those awful aspirant B&Bs that we've all been in with slightly sort of fusty things, and then that thing when you're at breakfast, and I hate being in a B&B, not that I do very often, and it's all quiet, and you can hear people eating their scrambled eggs, and I just go mad because of my sensitivities, and I would rather just skip the breakfast and not have to suffer that embarrassment. But I think,
or when, even worse, have to make conversation with other people.
Yes, over the scrambled egg eating. So the thing is, Fawlty Towers represents that part of Britain of it just not being top-notch, aspirant, pompous behaviour, getting it wrong, so we feel superior. I think it allows us to feel superior as a viewer.
Also irritable... It's you could point to John Cleese in Fawlty Towers or... Ricky Gervais or In the Office.
Yes.
Or they are all men. But Larry, I don't know if you're a Larry David yes. fan, but Larry David Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Oh.
They're all slightly pompous, spoilt men getting really irritated.
Yeah, and playing that up. There's an assumption that people will find that funny, and largely it's right, particularly in Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's very self-aware, but I don't know how he gets away with it because it's so pompous. But making comments about society at the same time, all that. But it is a standalone piece, this Fawlty Towers, and they did run it, and now I'm in it until the 13th of September, and I am loving it, and it is unique. It's farce. I know how to go in and out of a door very quickly. That's fun. I never thought I'd do that before.
Using some of the original lines?
Yes. He's put three episodes together, but there's a plot. And somehow it just really works. It's uncomplicated. And you hear people laughing. And that is, right now especially, you could say, go and see that. If you want to have a laugh, predictably, you probably have at least one. Which is good.
I presume it's a combination of those who are there, familiar with the lines.
Yes.
Almost predict them, presumably.
Some.
And those who haven't been there, that are so funny.
It's a bit of joy. It's a bit of joy. Uncomplicated joy. Quite unpretentious. Done by actors who are really good. I mean, that's the point. It's executed well. So there's nothing to worry about. Particularly in an afternoon matinee, you can go off and get yourself a nice rosé afterwards. You know, that's a nice kind of thing to do in this world, isn't it?
Heaven. And you launched the Comedy Women in Print, I think, 2019?
Yes, 2018. So I had been nominated for the PG Woodhouse Comedy Literary Prize for my novel, and I'd never been nominated for anything, and obviously didn't get it. But then it gave me the idea that there was no literary prize for witty women writers exclusively. So I'm an ideas person, Harry. You know, like I said to my parents once, age 10, we should have a fete in the garden. Guess what we did? You know, they had to pick up the pieces and do it. So I have run this, and I'm running it, Comedy Women in Print now. We've just had the long list out now.
With some famous names on
with
there.
With some famous names, Marion Keyes, Charlotte Mendelssohn, Monica, Kathy the person, Kathlete, and absolutely, and the woman who wrote Schitt's Creek, Monica Heasy, is it? But it's self-published, so we're saying, you know, people who do it for themselves. Quite a lot of older women in that category, as it happened. That wasn't a requirement, but that's what we've discovered. And quite a lot of cross-generational content in the unpublished. So it's a rags-to-riches prize. The unpublished writer becomes published by Hera. The self-published gets attention, and the published gets attention. So I have to be an administrator and bossy with that job. And it is creating writing careers for witty women writers who wouldn't otherwise be published. So it's not a bad thing to do. It's just quite time consuming.
I bet it is running anything, even your fate with your parents must have been quite time
consuming. Oh, the fate, yeah. My sister had to be the gypsy in the shed, and we had to have things where you throw things. We conjured stalls. We did it. But isn't that, yeah. So beware of ideas, basically.
A lot of work. Mm. And you say in your fantastic memoir, but it's, I would say, it shows a lack of self-confidence. You describe yourself being bottom of the top. Do you no longer think that you're so much going on now?
I'm busy right now, obviously the 8 shows a week and the Quip, but wanting to do more things while I can. Having to chase, having to self-promote. I mean, the actors in the cast, having to beg, but in a non-beggy way, casting directors come. You can't just stop. So I'm not in the Division A. I'm probably C. But it depends where you are. I mean, if I'm in a motorway getting a coffee, somebody might recognise me. That often happens. But in the real world, who's the man who does the sofa with the beard? Irish man, Norton. You know, the Graham Norton.
Yeah.
I'm not one of his dames. So the world we have is very delineated, and I kind of know exactly where I am and where I'm not. But the main thing is, you know, just keep doing it.
And if you don't mind me asking about your old friend, Tony Slattery, who very sadly died very recently. Was that because things weren't going well, or they didn't go well because he was ill?
I think you'd have to look at his life to say there were two parts to it, when he wasn't performing and when he was. And people remember him from the performing time because he made such an impact when he did. I mean, you must have loved
Brilliant.
Him.
And also absolutely everywhere.
Yes, yes, at the time. But Whose Line Is It, you know, launched him. But he was beautiful, witty, acerbic, brave, all those things, and happened to champion me. So that was a very important friendship to have. Which I miss, obviously. But he wasn't well a lot of the time. And
even when he was at his heights?
Yes, a combination of drugs and all sorts of, other stuff since diagnosed. But I don't think we were busy diagnosing things at the time. You just knew that that was who he was. But everyone loved Tony Slattery, so they couldn't believe when there was this documentary showing his more psychological side. I think people were shocked, but his actual...
It was very moving, and he'd obviously changed physically a lot. Yeah,
but his death was quite natural and sudden, as death can be. But I do, in the paperback, I write about the funeral, because I was in the pew with Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie, and I thought, here we go again. Asked to borrow a pen, because I thought, oh my God, there's people here, and I've got to name check them when I do my speech. And neither of them had a pen, and it was all mad. It was like we were taking part in another kind of sketch, but it was funny. It was just funny, and there we were, and me trying to people please and get things right. And Hugh Laurie is a very funny man. And I wrote about that funeral in the paperback just because a funeral's got to be funny as well.
Anyway, well, that's a rather somber note to end
on. Oh, God, I'm going to have to get a Kleenex.
No, but thank you so much to Helen Leder for appearing on Radio Oldie, and I'm looking forward to seeing her in Fawlty Towers. And do read her memoir,
Not that I'm bitter, to say in unison.
Thanks so much, Helen.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.